AI keeps giving us more choices. The bill arrives when those choices go wrong. Welcome to the Cato Daily Digest for August 2, 2026.
And the buyer now has a lot more ways to be wrong.
Yes. Choosing an AI system used to sound like choosing the best model. Find the leaderboard winner. Sign the contract. Today, that frame is too narrow. The real unit is the workload.
Meaning the job, the constraints, and the consequences.
Right. Does the work contain private data? Does it need cheap repeated inference? Do you need to modify the system? Is it writing code? Does it need remote scale? Those questions can point toward different models for different tasks and toward different ways of running them. Ollama and LM Studio lower the barrier to local use. OpenRouter gives teams access to multiple hosted models. Modal and Baseton offer paths to remote deployment. That is not one market. It is a stack of choices. The model is only one layer. The harness controls tools, permissions, context, workflow, and interface. You can keep the harness and swap the model, or keep the model and change the surrounding product. A mediocre model inside a well-designed harness can outperform a stronger model that lacks the right tools or context.
For one defined task, that caveat matters.
It does. Specialized models make the portfolio case stronger. Mistral says its 3 billion parameter Shieldstrahl safety classifier can match or beat models nearly 7 times its size. Liquid AI is releasing compact encoders for adaptation. Microsoft built MAI Cyber One Flash around vulnerability repair. The likely route to commoditization is substitution task by task, not one open model defeating every frontier system.
Here's my challenge. More choice sounds like buyer power because vendors become replaceable. But somebody must test the models, secure them, integrate them, monitor them, and handle failures. The model bill can fall while the engineering bill rises.
I agree. The relevant cost is the operated workflow. A model that costs half as much but needs twice the supervision is not cheaper. My read is that model portfolios will become normal because routing creates real savings on repetitive or narrow work. If that holds, we should see stable production systems shifting defined tasks among models without a jump in error rates. If teams keep retreating to one frontier provider for reliability, I have overstated the buyer's leverage.
There is also an uneven power problem. A large company can maintain an evaluation suite and a platform team. A small company may get nominal choice with no capacity to judge it.
Which leaves frontier providers with a strong counterposition. The integrated bundle may still win wherever dependable end-to-end behavior matters more than component price.
The buyer is no longer choosing a brain. The buyer is designing a workplace for several kinds of machine labor.
Model fragmentation and product management decentralization share a mechanism. The default bundle disappears, forcing operators to make more consequential choices.
Whatnot is the sharp case. Engineers and designers directly own more new product decisions. Product managers are hired against specific bottlenecks rather than assigned as standard coverage. The company reportedly received 31,832 PM applications over 2 years and hired one.
That number tells you this is an operating model, not a recruiting shortage. The positive case is about repetitions. Judgment develops when people make decisions, observe consequences, and correct themselves. If engineers always hand product questions to a PM, they may become excellent executors without learning which problem deserves execution.
But repetitions teach only when the feedback is legible. Repeatedly making calls inside a product with strong demand can create confidence without skill.
Twitter is the warning. It survived 9 product leaders in 2 years because network effects kept demand alive. Continued usage did not prove the organization was healthy.
Whatnot may have unusually product-minded engineers, unusually strong pull, or leaders who quietly perform the coordination work that disappeared from the org chart. That is the selection problem. You cannot observe one successful company and assign the success to fewer default PMs.
Conceded. Growth alone would not validate the design. We would need decision latency, reversal rates, experiment quality, duplicated work, and customer impacting errors. Compare problems with dedicated PM coverage against those without it.
And count where the coordination goes. Maybe engineers now spend 6 hours aligning stakeholders. Maybe data scientists become informal product managers. Maybe executives settle routine disputes because no one else owns the whole picture.
Then the company has not removed a cost. It has hidden it in more expensive people's calendars.
Exactly. Product pull can conceal that for a long time.
The stronger part of Whatnot's design is problem-based staffing. Put a PM against a current constraint because that person has the needed skill. Do not attach the role permanently to a team and assume value follows.
That also changes management. Whatnot expects PM managers to spend at least 90% of their time as individual contributors. Seniority is not meant to create distance from the work.
I like that principle, with a limit. Hands-on leaders retain execution judgment, but management contains real labor, coaching, conflict resolution, hiring, and building shared standards. If 90% individual contribution means that work happens at night, the organization is borrowing from its managers.
Or from the people who needed management and did not receive it.
Fair. There are two futures here. In one, engineers and designers gain product judgment through repeated ownership, while scarce PM talent attacks defined bottlenecks. In the other, coordination fragments, senior people absorb the mess, and product demand keeps the dashboard looking healthy.
The difference will not appear in a slogan about empowerment. It will appear in how quickly teams detect and repair bad decisions.
More decisions create capability only when evidence, consequences, and correction remain attached to ownership.
That attachment begins before an experiment launches. State what happens if the result is green. State what happens if it is red. Name what could break at scale. Then identify the evidence that would actually change the decision.
Otherwise, analysis becomes a ceremony after the choice. A team ships the feature, sees a mixed result, and invents a story that protects the original plan.
Which is easy when averages are available. Suppose only 3% of users touch a feature. The average says it is marginal. But if that 3% contains the customers who pay most or rely on it every day, removing it could do real damage.
So inspect the distribution. Pull cohorts. Read user logs. Put specific accounts beside aggregate numbers. Whatnot says AI tools now help PMs do work that used to wait in data science queues, including cohort analysis and regressions.
Faster access can improve diagnosis. It can also produce faster nonsense. A generated query may run perfectly while answering the wrong question.
That is where ownership must remain human. The analyst needs to know how the cohort was defined, which records were excluded, and whether the apparent effect survives another cut of the data.
And the decision rule must be set before the emotionally convenient result arrives.
Research agents face the same design problem. Scientist One's chain of evidence framework requires claims to trace back to verifiable evidence. Its tests reported no hallucinated references and perfect score verification.
Useful results, but bounded ones. Clean tests do not tell us how the architecture behaves when sources conflict, terminology is ambiguous, or the important fact is buried in a document that does not fit the expected format.
My hypothesis is that evidence architecture will matter more than another increase in Fluent output. The mechanism is error localization. If every claim points to the source and transformation behind it, a reviewer can find where the chain failed. If this holds, research agents should become dependable first in domains with structured evidence and explicit verification. If they perform equally well in open-ended disputes with weak sources, I have drawn the boundary too narrowly.
The scientific code cases support the bounded version. Across 8 case studies, agents helped modernize code through performance rewrites and maintenance work. People still verified the results and retained long-term ownership.
That division makes sense. Let the agent search a large solution space. Let it draft the rewrite. But the scientist owns whether the code preserves the physical or mathematical meaning of the model.
Because a speedup is not success if the simulation becomes subtly wrong.
Exactly. And human in the loop is too vague. Which human? Checking what? With what authority? A person clicking approve on 200 machine-generated changes is not meaningful oversight.
Human verification needs time, competence, and the power to stop deployment. Without those, the human is a liability sponge.
That phrase gets to the hidden economics. Automation often preserves a named human owner so the organization has someone to blame, while removing the conditions that let the person exercise judgment.
Then evidence is not a pile of citations. It is an operating relationship between a claim, a consequence, and someone able to intervene.
Evidence architecture for research agents has a capital analog. Commitments become credible when outcomes can be traced and verified.
Microsoft's Azure has passed $100 billion in annual revenue. AWS growth accelerated alongside AI spending. Those numbers give investors a visible bridge from data center expenditure to customers paying for capacity.
Meta and Apple face different questions. Meta has a large advertising business and can fund years of investment. But the path from new AI capacity to incremental revenue is less explicit. Apple still lacks a compelling AI product story. Time gives both companies options. It does not prove an adequate return.
Markets are not rejecting AI spending in general. They are pricing the legibility of the payoff.
Yes. Infrastructure becomes a productive commitment when usage produces revenue that can be traced against the cost of capacity. It remains a wager when management asks investors to accept capability today and monetization later.
That sounds almost too friendly to Microsoft and Amazon. Current cloud revenue does not prove each new AI data center will earn its cost of capital. Existing customers can hide weak returns on the next unit of spending.
That is the strongest counter. Revenue visibility is evidence, not proof. We still need utilization, margins, customer concentration, and the durability of demand. Azure crossing $100 billion does not tell us the return on every accelerator Microsoft buys.
And none of these revenue figures establishes that an autonomous system is cheaper than a person for a particular workflow. Technical ability, falling inference prices, and cloud growth are separate claims.
Good correction. I have sometimes compressed those into one direction of travel. Today's material does not provide the labor cost crossover. We should not invent it.
There are, again, two futures. Capacity becomes a utility customers repeatedly pay to use, or companies overbuild ahead of uncertain demand and discover that impressive models do not guarantee profitable workloads.
Revenue visibility tests. Private investment after money is committed. Incentive analysis tests public policy before predictable costs are imposed.
New York's proposed self-checkout discount is a compact example. If human checkout must cost more than automated checkout, shoppers receive a reason to choose the machine.
And grocers receive a reason to install more machines and schedule fewer cashiers. That runs against the stated labor goal.
A store could absorb the discount rather than pass it through, but grocery margins are thin. If one checkout method carries a mandated price difference, managers will try to move volume toward the cheaper lane.
The mechanism matters more than the protective language. Price human service above automation, and demand shifts toward automation. If the proposal were meant to preserve cashier jobs, it would need an incentive that makes human staffing more attractive, not less.
Noah Smith calls this kind of policy sloppulism, protective rhetoric attached to an untested or self-defeating mechanism.
I would test the claim before turning it into a broad label. Measure lane choice, staffing hours, store prices, and closures. If human checkout use rises without a reduction in cashier shifts, the policy's defenders have a case. If machine use rises and staffing falls, the reversal is visible.
The human cost is not evenly shared. A shopper gets a small discount. A cashier faces fewer hours. A low-margin neighborhood store may face higher operating costs. The politician keeps the labor-friendly headline.
That is the accountability gap. The person receiving credit for the promise may not bear the cost of the mechanism.
And once the policy fails, supporters can blame greedy stores or impatient shoppers. Every actor followed the incentive, yet the design escapes judgment.
Which is why conditional planning belongs in policy, too. Before passage, say what outcome would count as success, when the rule will be reviewed, and what evidence would trigger repeal or redesign.
A sunset clause is the policy version of a reversible product decision.
Yes. Protection without measurement can become exposure for the people named in the protection.
A system can formally offer choice while shaping incentives so strongly that the resulting agency becomes largely cosmetic.
That takes us from checkout lanes to attention. Writers are receiving AI-generated praise and invitations to fake book club events. Then comes the bill for promotion.
The scam works because the message is personalized around a real desire. Someone read my work, understood it, and wants to celebrate it. AI makes that emotional key cheap to cut at scale.
The risk is not merely low-quality content. It is optimized persuasion aimed at professional insecurity.
And the victim still clicks. Formally, that is a choice. But describing it only as choice ignores the system built to manufacture trust at the exact point where the person wants recognition.
How do you distinguish persuasion from coercion without denying the person's responsibility?
By asking whether the system improves the person's ability to evaluate the offer or deliberately reduces it. Fake praise conceals the seller's identity, invents social proof, and creates urgency. Its purpose is to prevent informed judgment.
The slower counterweight is recurring local contact. Lenny's members have organized meetups from Asheville and Austin to Barcelona, Dublin, Lisbon, and Lithuania. The platform helps people find one another, but members host the gatherings.
Recognition there is earned through repeated presence. Someone remembers what you said last month. They see whether you follow through. That relationship has friction, which is part of its value.
A fake invitation can mimic warmth in seconds. It cannot easily mimic history.
Professional vulnerability also appears in the burden of potential. Emily North describes potential as a clock. Every hour of rest becomes evidence that you are failing the future version of yourself.
There is no external scammer in that case.
Not necessarily. The persuader can be an internalized audience. Employers, platforms, and status markets supply the metrics, but the person learns to police every unoptimized hour. The imagined future displaces the life already present.
Then more options do not create freedom. A person can choose among 10 ambitious projects while feeling unable to choose rest.
Real agency requires distance from the desire. Enough space to ask, do I want this, or do I want relief from feeling inadequate?
Courtney Martin's account of her daughter offers a smaller practice. Feel the emotion directly. Repair quickly. Leave an activity when it no longer feels alive. Let an identity change.
Adults often treat consistency as proof of character. Children can reveal the cost. Staying loyal to an old description may look disciplined while preventing honest revision.
There is a risk of romanticizing impulse. Quitting whenever something feels hard can destroy mastery and trust.
That is the steel man. Commitment matters because moods move. The question is whether a choice survives reflection, repair, and contact with other people, not whether it remains unchanged forever.
Here's the new connection I take from all this. Support is part of agency, not an exception to it. Evaluation tools help a small team choose a model. Shared evidence helps an engineer own a product call. A reviewer helps a scientist use an agent safely. A recurring community helps a person test whether an invitation or ambition is real.
Which means independence is often produced socially. The isolated chooser is easiest to manipulate because every cost of verification lands on one person.
That updates my opening image. The bill does not have to arrive after the wrong choice if evidence and support are present before the choice is made.
So, where in your work or life have you gained more choice but not yet gained the evidence, distance, or support needed to exercise real judgment?
Until next time.
Choose slowly and stay human.